Welcome to the 17th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Angelica Welch. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. On October 10th, we headed to Newport Beach, California for a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal cancers. The meeting focused on the evolving paradigms of colorectal cancer, pancreatic cancer, neuroendocrine tumors, gastric cancer, and hepatocellular carcinoma. The field of GI cancers has been shifting in recent years to incorporate more tailored treatments and checkpoint inhibitors. In HCC, for example, the FDA recently granted an accelerated approval to pembrolizumab for the treatment of patients who have previously received sorafenib. The approval is based on findings from the Phase 2 KEYNOTE-224 trial, in which single-agent pembrolizumab led to an overall response rate of 17%. At the meeting, we asked each faculty member to discuss where research should focus on each of their areas of specialty. First, we spoke with one of the meeting co-chairs, Anthony Alquieri, MD, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the University of Southern California, Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center, to discuss the promising HCC treatment paradigm. In a disease where sorafenib was the sole FDA-approved agent, oncologists are encouraged by the growth in the pipeline. The treatment landscape now includes frontline lenvatinib, as well as nivolumab and regorafenib in the second-line setting. Other agents continue to show promise. Here is what Dr. Alquieri had to say.
It's been an exciting time for the treatment of hepatocellular cancer. We've gone from having one drug approved in this space, which was sorafenib for about 10 years, to now having multiple options and across multiple lines of therapy. So in my talk, I'm covering the evolution of treatment in first line, where we now have a new compound, lenvatinib, which was not inferior to sorafenib. We're all awaiting the results of the Phase 3 trial comparing the anti-PD-1 agent nivolumab to sorafenib in first line. Those results have not come out yet. Then we cover the second line options where we have the approval for regorafenib in patients who had previous treatment with sorafenib. Regorafenib was compared to placebo showing a survival benefit. In addition to that, we have data from cabozantinib. In the cabozantinib trial, patients had failed one prior line of therapy, but they may they were allowed to have failed one or two prior lines of therapy, so they were up to two prior lines, and in that trial there was a survival benefit compared to placebo as well. Then we have the accelerated approval for nivolumab that was granted last year in 2017 for patients who had prior treatment with sorafenib. That approval is for patients who had prior sorafenib, so it could also be used second or third line. We now have also more recent data from ramucirumab, the anti-VEGF receptor 2 antibody, from the REACH2 trial. This study was actually restricted to patients with an AFP level of 400 or higher, and that was also a positive trial. So in a nutshell, multiple new options. I think the challenge into the future is how to best sequence these options and how to align them best. We are also awaiting the Phase 3 results of pembrolizumab versus best supportive care in second line. The field is now headed towards combination therapies, and we can talk more about that. So at the ELCA meeting, there was a lot of discussion about some of the evolving early trials, including some looking at combinations. And the combinations range, the combination mostly are looking at anti-PD-1 agents or anti-PD-L1 agents with either tyrosine kinase inhibitors such as sorafenib, lenvatinib, etc., or with anti-VEGF antibodies. So for example, one of the trials that was presented there was the combination of atezolizumab with bevacizumab, showing a very intriguing response rate of 60% in a small number of patients. So, you know, we have to interpret that with caution. We are awaiting more data. But certainly there is excitement about the potential for the effect of the combination of anti-PD-1 agents with anti-VEGF agents or TKIs in general. There was also a lot of discussion about the biology of hepatocellular cancer, because I think the challenge in the future is how to best select patients for specific therapies. Another challenge in the field that was addressed a little bit at ILCA was how to transition from local regional therapy to systemic therapy. When is the perfect time? How much taste is enough taste? And, you know, naturally we don't have consensus on this, but there's more and more data that shows that after two or three episodes of taste, patients who don't have a complete response or are having developed new lesions or having progression in treated lesions should really be transitioned to systemic therapy. We don't necessarily have to await the progression to extrahepatic disease. Now that we have more agents for systemic therapy, this transition from local regional to systemic treatment is becoming important and critical, and is going to be the subject of a lot of studies in the near future.
After chatting with Dr. El-Khoueiry, we met with Dr. Saima Iqbal, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California, who highlighted updates in the NET paradigm. Specifically, the January 2018 FDA approval of Lutathera has led to a change in the management of patients with gastroenteropancreatic NETs. The Lutathera approval was based on a 79% decrease in the risk of progression or death compared with high-dose octreotide seen in the Phase 3 NETTER-1 trial. Also, the median overall survival was not reached with Lutathera, compared with 27.4 months in the control arm. Iqbal discusses approval as well as the challenges to diagnosing NETs.
Since I'm actually giving an overview on the treatment of neuroendocrine tumors, and this used to be a very rare disease that oncologists really hardly saw, but the incidence has been increasing, and so I think we're seeing more and more of it. I think we're just identifying it better. I think what's been great in the field of neuroendocrine tumors is this was a disease where we had no options for quite a while. We would basically tell patients, we're going to watch you if they had a slow-growing disease. And that was uncomfortable for patients and for oncologists. What's happened in this field is that there's really been a boom over the last few years, where we've gone from somatostatin analogs to now we have PRRT, which is peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, which is really an effective therapy that has finally been approved in the U.S. for the treatment of these patients. On top of that, in between, we've had clinical trials that have shown us that targeted therapies, mTOR inhibitors, VEGF inhibitors, also have demonstrated activity in this disease. So suddenly, we have several treatment options. This was a disease that used to primarily be treated by surgeons, interventional radiologists, because we were doing local regional therapy, blading, and what have you. But now we have several options. I don't think we know clearly how to sequence these options now. But we've gone from a disease where there was really nothing in my career to now where we have lots of options and we have effective options for these patients. And what's great about this disease is if you do have well-differentiated, low-grade disease, these patients live a very long time. So they're going to probably go through multiple lines of treatment. And so I think that's where we actually need to figure out, you know, how do we best sequence these therapeutics so that we're not harming individuals so they can get to the next line if they need it in the future. So I think it's actually a really exciting area. The NETTER trial, a randomized study looking at somatostatin versus lutetium-labeled octreotide, basically with a hazard ratio of 0.2, which I don't think I've ever seen a hazard ratio like that before, really offering a significant benefit to these patients, a very well-tolerated regimen, and I think given the FDA approval just this year, actually, I think that this will now be something that's used fairly commonly given how well patients have done with it, the long-term benefit that they've seemed to have achieved from it. But again, I think this field also needs more in terms of identifying which patients are going to respond to what, because now we do have options. And immunotherapy is also coming into the mix. In neuroendocrine tumors as well, both in the low-grade and high-grade tumors. So there's still a lot to be explored in this disease. You know, what I think is really interesting about neuroendocrine tumors is it takes 5 to 7 years for patients to actually get a diagnosis from when they first start experiencing symptoms. Now, that's not something that oncologists actually do. They don't actually diagnose these patients. But I think given that the incidence is increasing, there does need to be more education perhaps around those folks who are actually seeing these patients, so gastroenterologists, primary care physicians. These patients present a very, very odd constellation of symptoms. They're given all sorts of other diagnoses before they actually present with their disease, and then unfortunately most of these folks actually wind up presenting with metastatic disease. So I think education in that diagnostic area is an important part hopefully finding earlier stage disease.
Iqbal also shared her insight on gastric cancers, discussing current treatment approaches for patients and highlighting the recent upcoming trials in immunotherapy. The effects of immunotherapy have been observed in microsatellite instability high tumors, which is thought to be due to their tumor mutational burden.
It may be that immunotherapy doesn't add enough to how well chemotherapy does frontline to for gastric cancer. But I think it could be that we need a combined approach. It could be we just need to identify those patients that are going to have the best chance of responding. And it may not be the CPS score that we're currently using to identify PD-L1 positive patients. So it may be something else. So I think the field is really focusing on tailoring therapy, splitting instead of lumping patients together, trying to optimize treatment in the patients who we think may respond to whatever therapeutic that we're approaching. So in gastric cancer, the only targeted therapy, the only biomarker that's been consistent has been HER2. Those patients who are HER2 positive do better when they're given HER2 suppression in the frontline setting with Herceptin or trastuzumab. So after that, we haven't really clearly identified a reliable biomarker, I would say. We do use PD-L1 positivity to give immunotherapy, the PD-L1 antibodies to patients, but I'm not sure if we can say that that's the right marker. So I think we're still looking. So in upper GI tumors or in gastric cancer, I think we've still limited ourselves to only that HER2 story, which needs to expand. And even frankly, the HER2 story is an interesting one in that the second line continued suppression of the HER2 receptor has not shown to be of any benefit. So that's been very disappointing as well. So there's clearly a marker in the frontline setting, and then the rest, I think, is still to be discovered.
In colorectal cancer, the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab in the frontline setting of MSI-high, mismatch repair-deficient metastatic disease is one of a number of regimens that were eagerly awaited. Late-breaking results presented at the 2018 ESMO Congress demonstrated nivolumab and low-dose ipilimumab could be the new first-line treatment for select patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. Heinz-Joseph Lenz, the Associate Director for Adult Oncology and co-leader of the Gastrointestinal Cancers Program at the University of Southern California Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center, discussed the excitement with the study and the developments of other new therapies.
Yeah, so we're living in the middle of a molecular revolution of colorectal cancer. We have learned a lot about molecular genetics of colon cancer and how this will translate into treatment decision in everyday clinical practice. But there is so much more to come. We have just scraped the surface of colon cancer with DNA mutation analysis. Now we have gene expression analysis showing that they may even be more helpful in the future. Tonight, I will really paint the future in the treatment of metastatic colon cancer, particularly integrating novel and cutting-edge technology such as liquid biopsy. They will come and are already used in many clinical practices, giving us for the first time insight in real-time molecular monitoring. The testing of molecular genetic makeup at the time of diagnosis is everywhere done. Only the question is how extensive the panel would be. But with liquid biopsy, we can now capture not only the tumor heterogeneity of different metastatic site, but we can do that with an easy blood draw at the time of progression of disease, which means we know what cells died, what cells survived, and what their molecular genetics is, making us it easier to decide what potential treatment options these patients have. So a completely new way of doing and monitoring our patient with metastatic disease, identifying potential novel targets which are not part of the routine treatment for this patient population. So we are very excited about these opportunities and, of course, integrating the novel targeted treatments such as immunotherapy for microsatellite high metastatic colon cancer, which will be moved into first line. We will present this data actually at ESMO in Munich in 2 weeks, showing incredible promising data set. We're going to review the new treatments for HER2-directed colon cancer. HER2 usually only seen or treated in gastric and breast cancer, but we know up to 10% of patients with colorectal cancer receiving EGF receptor-based treatment can develop HER2 alterations, and the efficacy of HER2-targeted drugs are extremely promising. And the new change for BRAF mutant, one of the most poor prognostic marker we know in metastatic disease, we have now a treatment options which is without any classical chemo, showing high response rate and long progression-free survival. And I have no doubt this will also move into first line the years to come. So a lot of exciting news, new treatment options for our patients, new technologies allowing us to find better treatment options for our patients. So regorafenib is a multi-kinase inhibitor, and I think there are unique aspects to it why it has efficacy in refractory disease. I think one of the most surprising facts is that this anti-angiogenic drug still has efficacy even when patients were treated previously with bevacizumab, because it captures some of the escape mechanism with its targets. Now, I think regorafenib struggled a long time with the dosing. The recommended dose of 160 milligrams can be toxic. And I think learning and going with the side effect profile and the timing of the side effect is very critical. When you monitor on a weekly basis, you capture it early enough, because I think very critical is if the side effect happens, it will happen in the first couple of weeks, not later on. So you need to monitor very closely. There was always ongoing discussion, should you start all patients with 160 milligrams, but maybe 120. So many of my peers, including myself, started with 120. Now, a redose study, which we participated in, showed that you can actually start with 80. And if you don't see any dose limiting toxicity, you can go to 120. And with no, you can do 160. Now, the data were presented at ASCO GI and at ASCO showing that this is not only feasible, it led to longer progression-free survival. And the reason is that you can safely give the drug. It doesn't lead to significant dose interruptions with no treatment, which can last 1 or 2 or 3 weeks. So I think safer dose escalation with a redose study showed us it does not only not jeopardize the outcome, it improves the outcome for this patient population. So most of the clinical trials, including clinical practice, have adjusted very quickly to the new redose schedule. With TAS-102, there are some developments because particularly in combination treatments, as you probably know, there are trials showing very promising survival benefit of TAS-102 with bevacizumab compared to capecitabine bevacizumab. So that is actually a new step forward, how we should use this information integrating into our clinical lines of treatment. Should that go further in earlier lines of treatment? Because this study was done for patients with newly diagnosed metastatic disease, not fit for classical doublet or triplet chemotherapy. But it showed certainly promising survival benefit for patients treated with TAS and bevacizumab. So for MSI high, I think the effect will be that nivo-ipi, when the data are presented in Munich, has a chance to get in first line because the efficacy data seem to be very convincing. I think what happens for the MSS patients is like, should we combine immunotherapy with standard chemotherapy, FOLFOX, bevacizumab, with Nivo? And these trials are all ongoing. For MSI high in the adjuvant setting, we don't know if immunotherapy will work. So here the question is, should we do FOLFOX and immunotherapy? And this is a cooperative group in the US which exactly going to test the benefit in this patient population.
Moving into the pancreatic cancer space, we spoke with Dr. Afsana Barzi, who is an assistant professor of clinical medicine and medical director of the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California and the USC Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. Studies in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant settings have been highly anticipated in the field, such as one looking at the combination of adjuvant gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. Dr. Barzi also discussed the importance of genetic testing.
A French trial that was published a few years ago established that upfront chemoradiation is actually inferior to starting with chemotherapy. For a while, the standard practice has been to start these patients on gemcitabine and follow, maybe look to see if they have responded or not responded, maybe look for resectability. But then the response rate to gemcitabine is so poor that very few of these patients ever got to have surgery. The LAPAC trial that was presented looked at the combination of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. In the initial trial, in the IMPACT trial, the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel was only used in metastatic population, so we didn't have any data for basically efficacy of this treatment in the locally advanced population. So the LAPAC trial established that 36% of the patients responded to treatment, and about 15% of them actually went for surgery. There is also the a meta-analysis of a few smaller FOLFIRINOX studies that are done in the locally advanced population, and about 28% of those patients actually were able to go for surgery. So I think those numbers are impressive, and I think that what that tells us is that as our chemotherapies are getting better when we treat locally advanced patients, we should not forget that we should reevaluate them for resectability. It is not a done deal. And so for medical oncologists, we should not forget that, you know, when we give these patients stronger, more potent therapies, we are potentially rendering them resectable. And every single time they have a staging study, we should discuss it with our surgeons to see if they're at a point for resection. They may not be, but, you know, those few that we can find and resect them are worth the effort.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 17th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you want to hear more about therapeutic advances in lung cancer, considering registering for our State of the Science Summit on November 28th in New York. You can catch us in Memphis, Tennessee on November 29th for a State of the Science Summit on prostate cancer and renal cell carcinoma. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.